Major Han, Reel 32.
You were saying the artillery was preparing.
Yes, well, they put up a barrage for about 3 hours, and the RAF were also, you know, they really were getting a good pounding and making it easy for when we went through. And, of course, the whole of the New Zealand Division and the 1st Armoured Division were in a block almost. And it was just before dark, just before dusk, that they all, went straight through.
A night attack?
Well, it was just before dark. It was going to be.
So they started off in the twilight.
That's right. Yes. And so it went right through. And so it continued, actually. It got to the stage, really, where you didn't know who was friend and foe.
I was going to ask if you'd done a night attack before.
No.
Had you done any training for night attacks?
I don't know whether the division had or anything, but that was the thing. I think that probably surprised Rommel. And with all the preparation of the bombing, the shelling, and that's just a matter of saying, right, go. And the tanks were obviously leading with their firepower. We were on the flanks, protecting the flanks, the regiment. Of the whole thing as they went through. And so it was just a matter of just going and blasting. And we stopped for a short time when it got really dark. So you couldn't see what's it until the moon came up. And then we went on again. And by then, you know, everywhere was a light, burning, tank burning, various other things. And people just relied on going forward and...
on a bearing?
On a bearing, yeah.
Were you
for El Hammer.
Were you going ahead of the main movement or were you following them up?
We were on the flanks.
You were doing the flank guard?
We were doing flank guard. And that was our role at the time.
Did you encounter any opposition going forward?
Oh, you could see lots of enemy... You know, which you'd report, you know, and probably get it dealt with. But it was a matter, I think, of people just going and hoping for the best. That, you know, that they'd just overrun the enemy. And the opposition, as such, once the main force had gone through, was so small that they could be dealt with piecemeal.
Or mopped up?
Yeah.
What was the ground like then on your flank?
It was very sandy, but flat. And open, that was quite good. There was no sort of wadis or anything to overcome. That was quite pretty good going.
What sort of pace were you going at to keep up with the advance? And did you go steadily or did you keep...
I think it was steadily. There wasn't any flat out, you know, you couldn't afford to go flat out, really. It was just a pace that a driver could see reasonably to and I think the tanks would fire ahead whether they had a target or not.
What, prophylactic fire?
Yeah.
So you were going, were you moving in tactical bounds or were you just motoring on?
Just motoring.
And this was in the dark?
Yeah.
And you could see things in the... What could you see in the dark?
Silhouettes mainly.
Silhouettes.
Lots of flaming vehicles.
And flashes, presumably.
And, of course, when the moon came up, that was a bit better.
Oh, yes.
But it's something that we've never been done before, to go forward like that. And I think it was a thing which probably the enemy didn't expect anyway.
Took them by surprise.
I think so. And that was a good move. And I think the sheer weight of numbers sort of one of the day, plus the fact that the battering they'd taken from the RAF and from the gunners.
The Germans always had a reputation for not liking work at night. They had a reputation for wanting to put on their pyjamas and go to bed.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that probably caught a few of them in bed.
But it was always said that they didn't like night operations because they were more difficult to control.
Yes.
And it was easier to get lost. And
that's right. They, of course, in daylight you can keep control, whereas
more easily
you can't sort of say who's coming up behind you or what.
Mm. I mean, how could you tell the difference between friend and enemy?
You can say it was sheer, I think, weight of numbers and the size of the area it covered, which allowed, once you got through with your front line, everything behind that was yours.
You got it as enemy, or you got it as friendly.
You might have been on the flank.
Yes.
But you'd still have your flank guards to deal with that.
Yes.
You see, so once you have got through, with a sheer number of, you get two divisions going over an area, covered a lot of ground, and providing they knocked out anything that was in front of them, and any infantry in slit trenches, they'd be overrun with the tanks going over them and various other vehicles. I haven't read up at all about that particular battle in detail or anything, but it'd be interesting to read what the historians say about it.
How long did this advance last before you paused? Was it all night long, or did you stop?
No, it started at dusk. Or just late afternoon, let's say, and that lasted then, possibly, that'd be about 4 or 5 hours. Then the moon came up, and then we went on again. I think by about 5:30 in the morning or something, as daylight came, and I think we were, you know, well in control.
So would that mean you'd be advancing for about 12 hours or so?
Roughly that, I should say. Might have been less.
Did you have any idea at the time of distance, or were you just too...
No. Well, we knew on the map where El Hammer was. So that was our objective, El Hammer.
And you got there by about 5 in the morning?
Something like that, I think. We were there by about dawn. But by then, the enemy were quite well organised. They had their 88s in position all around El Hammer, so that's what was holding us up from there.
So you hadn't actually got into El Hammer itself?
We hadn't got into El Hammer.
You were on the outskirts.
But all around the whole area, you know, it showed the devastation of burning enemy vehicles and huge tankers that had been shot up and exploded, you know, and the bodies of the drivers laying around and the bears. There was quite a lot of concentrated damage and destruction and bodies, which I think, being in such a small area, showed up more than, say, coming through Alamein.
It sounds like that, so you did catch the enemy by surprise if you got in amongst their fuel transport and so on.
Yeah. But again, a lot of that might have been due to the RAF.
Earlier on,
you see, but the bodies were still there with them, so it could well have been the tanks as well as they went through with the divisions. But, as I say, on the outskirts of El Hammer, we were held up the 88, so we didn't actually go straight through as we hoped for anyway. And also there was loads of prisoners coming in, hundreds of prisoners, and I think they were a bit dazed and whatnot, having been sort of attacked at night. And I think it's worse when you're attacked at night than in daytime.
Well, it's much more difficult to know what to do.
I think people then become more frightened in the dark, because they think something's going to happen, or they imagine things, where in daylight you can see and your imagination doesn't run away with you.
That's quite true, but conversely, in the dark it's easier for you to hide if you're being attacked, isn't it?
Depend on what hiding place you have. See, on a desert, flat ground, where's the hiding place? With loads of tanks coming over the ground, no good digging a hole because the tank would come and bury you. You know, I think it's more frightening. I think if you're in a forest, or, you know, in a place like Italy, the darkness is gives you a safer haven, but on a flat desert, there's no hiding place, I don't think, really.
So you're more vulnerable in the dark than you would be in daytime.
Yeah. In daylight, you can see and you can say, right, get on your vehicle or whatever and go flat out, or know where the enemy is and probably put your hands up, depending on the situation.
Take evasive action or surrender.
Yes, right. But, now, I think darkness can be a blessing if you've got the cover.
Depends on the circumstances, then.
Yes. But that sort of light must have been most frightening for the enemy. I know for us, it was exciting, and just as frightening, I suppose, really, because you didn't know what you were going into.
No, you wouldn't know if you were going to run into a minefield, would you?
No.
Do you know if there were any minefields?
I don't know. I doubt it. Well, we certainly didn't come across any. I think as we got nearer to the mouth defences, there would have been, but we sort of bypassed them. We came in well behind. As I say, they put in a lot of anti-tank guns, and it wasn't until, 29th March, a lot of the enemy had left the Marath line and avoided the encirclement as Montgomery had planned by holding up El Hamma and allowing the people to escape from the Marath line up the coast road and again make for another mixed defensive position.
Mm-hmm. So the outflanking move worked and the Marath line.
It saved us the frontal attack on the Marath, I don't think would have been possible. So it saved us time. And obviously casualties would have been greater on a frontal attack than the one we did.
Coming round the side.
I think about the 29th of March when we got into El Hamma, which was a sort of a vital communications point, I think. So, but anyway, the enemy escaped, or a lot of the enemy escaped, from the Marath line up the coast road, although we lost quite a lot, in defending the south and round El Hamma.
Did the enemy withdraw from El Hamma voluntarily, or were they attacked and forced out?
I think they knew they couldn't hang on to it with the amount of stuff that was to the south of it. And so I think it was a case of delaying as much as they could to allow the people to get away from the main defence.
So allow the evacuation.
Get out, to go to the next line of defence, which was the Wadi Akarit. Accurate, yes, that's right. And that was another deepish wadi, and it stretched from the sea straight across the front down to a salt marsh.
So it had a secure flanks then?
So that was another. All his defences, you see, were rather like in Italy, with a river line. These were wadis which were difficult to cross. It would have been even more difficult if they'd have been full of water. Mm. But they were still difficult enough to advance with any strength with tanks and things, and the enemy on one side sort of defending. But again, that was a deep body. Um, it was impossible, I think, to attack with any strength with tanks because of the depth of it and that. And again, a very difficult place for infantry to attack. And I think in the end, I'm not absolutely certain, but I think that they put in the Gurkhas to do a night attack on that. But, you know, I can't say offhand, but I've got a feeling that's what happened. So in the back of my mind, I saw people saying, oh, the Gurkhas went in and did a night attack on it, and they were pretty effective, which I think secured the body.
So they would have been part of 4th Indian Division, wouldn't they, if the Gurkhas?
Yes, because they were. It was the 4th and the 8th Indian Division, I think, were both on the desert. I know they were in Italy, but I think I could fourth or the eighth.
Well, the 5th Indian Division was in North Africa, but then later on it was sent off to Burma.
Yeah.
The Ball of Fire Division. The 4th Indian Division had the kite as its symbol, the shite hawk, they called it.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
You may remember that.
Yes, the 4th. That's right. It was the 4th Indian Division. And then the 8th, I can't remember what theirs was. But the 8th were in... I'm certain they were in Italy, if they weren't in North Africa. But
what was your role at Wadi Akaret? Because it sounds like there wasn't really
much
scope for armoured cars in that kind of...
We had to wait until the breakthrough, and then we came into our arms. So you sort of hung around, sort of waiting. You know, you couldn't go back and rest. You were just in places, just waiting to go. And
did you have a chance to see the defences at Wadi Akaret?
No. You could when you went through them, but you couldn't sort of go up and look at them beforehand.
But when you went through them, what sort of strength were they?
Well, you couldn't tell. It was mainly, I think, anti-tank guns that would be there, you know, which would cover the forward area and infantry. You couldn't get a view as there wasn't a sort of built-up defence.
It wasn't a concrete defence line.
It was just a matter of... you use the ground for your tanks and for your anti-tank guns.
So there would there be field works? Presumably there'd be gun pits and things like that.
Not necessarily, because you know the time of doing it. And I think it was a case of they'd have mobile. They'd always have an anti-tank gun, an 88, in such a position that they could hook it on and get it away.
Double quick.
They used to be on the four wheels, didn't they? So they could hook him up and go. So I don't think there was any need for a gun pit for that type of vehicle because they had the range to knock out the tanks before they could be engaged themselves to any great extent. So I don't think that they needed to waste time on... they probably didn't have the manpower to...
dig them in.
See? And there'd probably be tanks in certain positions too to... try to take on the infantry, certainly in the daytime. But I think I'm pretty certain it was at Wadi Akaret where the Gurkhas went in and did on a night attack, which then sort of helped clear the way of it. Because I don't think the Germans liked the Gurkhas very much at all.
Well, the Gurkhas have a certain reputation.
Yeah. And the Highlanders did too.
Yes. So. Well, again, the Germans have said not to like the use of cold steel.
No, no.
Which the Gurkhas are rather fond of, especially at night.
Yeah, they'd be in their element, wouldn't they?
They would.
Yeah. So I think that was a great thing which helped. I've got that they had quite a battle there, and they had to abandon the defences on about the 6th of April. And I don't know what... Did I tell you a date when they started it?
I think you're saying something about 29th of March.
Yeah. As I said, that's right. That's when we went into El Hamma.
Mm.
So it'd be
a day or two after that.
Mm. You know, they sort of held us up for about a week.
Mm.
And but the following day we were heading in the direction of Gafsa. That's where the Americans were coming from.
Were you aware of the Americans and First Army?
We started to hear little bits on the radio coming in onto our frequency, like Roger Out and sort of the American sort of terms. Mm. We could hear occasionally with an American sort of saying something on his network, which we'd pick up on ours.
Mm.
So we knew we were getting close. And we knew Gafsa was one of the American strong points at one time, wasn't it? One of the towns where they had a big battle there, I think.
Yeah. Did you have any news about what had been going on, you know, in First Army? Had you heard of the Kasserine Pass, for example?
Oh, yes, we used to hear that, and we used to all say, you know, the... what's it... Rommel had been sort of topping up with supplies from Kasserine or Gafsa.
Mm.
But, we got the general news that they were coming our way, and we knew they were coming as we were making for Gafsa. We had an idea we were going to meet up with them.
Mm.
And in fact, five troop, B squadron, and it was John Richardson and his troop sergeant, was Maggie Braun, met up with the Americans. They were the first of the 8th Army to meet up with the Americans coming from Gafsa.
When did you first see them? Was this around about the same time? Or
yes, oh, at the same time.
Mm.
Yeah. In fact, while they were meeting up, John Richardson and the Americans, I'd been told, I was held up at Wadi Akra.
Yeah.
Of course, the supply vehicle with the petrol and ammunition had broken down, and I had to get it repaired and bring it up to squadron headquarters, which would be the same day, about probably an hour or two behind, that's all. Got it going and said, right, come on, because the squadron had to get on. Each troop had an area to go to and John Richardson had met up with the Americans. I came up with the supply vehicle, and just as I got to the squadron headquarters with the supply vehicle 5 or 10 minutes beforehand, Neil Speak, who was squadron leader, and Tap Brinton, who was second in command, had seen a convoy of lorries and so they said, right, whips out, attack. So they went charging in, machine gunning these lorries, and sat in the middle of them was a tank.
Mm.
One shell went straight through the second in command's driver's visa. And that was young chap Punter, Eric Punter, was the driver. Took his head off, went straight through, went between Tap Brinton's legs and Woolhouse, who was his operator, that's way. Went straight through, missed them, and out the other end. Neil Speak, a shell came through the side, took off Paddy Doran's legs, and of course he died later. And so the second command and the squadron leader and their two operators, Bob Cook and Woolhouse, were taken prisoner by this convoy of lorries. I assumed command of the squadron for a short time with the medical officer as second command.
Did he know about armoured tactics?
No. But he was passing stuff back to RHQ. I was, you know, giving him the.
So you were giving orders to the medical officer.
Yeah, to pass back to the squad, the commanding officer.
So he was acting as a relay, in essence.
The rear link sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I was doing the squad leaders thing. Mm. And sort of in touch with the rest of the troops. And then the troops, three troop leaders, got together, and Matt Abraham managed to get hold of an American unit, which we'd just met up with a tank, and went after the convoy. The tank disappeared, and they shot up the convoy. Needle speak, squadron leader, and the second command, and the two other chaps jumped out of the vehicle. The Germans then became our prisoners, and Neil Speak and the second command were back in the squadron within a couple of hours.
So they're only POWs for a very short time.
Very short time. But it was, you know, very fortunate, really. And fortunate in a way, because if I'd have been with them, half an hour earlier, I'd have been probably in the bag as well, with them, with probably my driver killed, or all of us, we don't know. Mm. But it was all happened at the same time as the Americans were
making contact
with Fire Troop. Mm. And of course, the Americans were the great big stew made of it, you know, the Americans meeting up with the Brits. And of course, they couldn't do that, because this thing happened, and that was going out and saying, "Oh yeah," and sort of shook hands, and they then had to rip off to, you know, help rescue the squadron leader, you know. So it sort of fizzled out as far as the Americans were concerned, because they wanted to make a big thing of it. You know?
What impression did you get of them when you first saw them?
They were all right, but they want to impress you, I found. The first thing one of them said was, he said, "I heard you had quite a barrage at Alamein. We heard that was quite a big barrage," he said, "but you should have seen the one we put up at Gafsa. It was fantastic," he said, "and we caught a German general. And this German general said, 'Well, look, you can shoot me, you can poison me, you can do what you like to me, but before I die, let me see these automatic cannons you Yanks have got.'" And that was the first sort of conversation with the Americans at that stage.
Did you think they were efficient when you saw them operating?
Well, from what we had the opinion of hearing about what was happening at Gafsa and all that sort of thing, we didn't think they were efficient at all. We thought they'd lost masses of equipment, you know, unnecessarily. Probably we didn't get the full story of it, but we thought with what they had, they should have done better. But it's only us on the ground probably not having the full detail. You can't sort of judge on that. But we got the idea that they lost a fantastic amount of equipment, good equipment, unnecessarily. Probably bad tactics or, you know.
Inexperience, perhaps.
Inexperience.
Because the Germans are not exactly inexperienced, were they?
Well, they were pretty well trained by them, weren't they? They had all the training. But there again, I think on the whole they were friendly, you know. It's they were there to do a job, and I think they obviously did a job, otherwise they wouldn't have met up with us when they did. But then they had more contact with the First Army than the Eighth Army. So we couldn't see much of how they did operate.
Did you see anything of First Army?
Of who? First Army?
First Army.
Well, later we did, yes, because we went to join them.
But not at this stage?
No, later. But as I say, we lost Paddy Dore and Eric Palmer.